to be available with others. That's enough.
Hello, you're listening to Ensemble Means Together. I'm Noah Graham. In today's episode, we hear from Ariel Gutierrez-Torres, who is on the faculty of Arthouse Berlin, International School for Devised Theater and Performance. I should start by explaining that Arthouse Berlin originated as LISPA, the London International School of Performing Arts, founded in 2003 by Thomas Pratke, former pedagogical director of the École Jacques Lecoq, and Amy Russell, chair of Naropa University's MFA in Lecoq-based actor-created physical theater. LISPA closed and was reborn as Arthouse Berlin in 2018. Originally from Buenos Aires, Ariel has a background in international politics, literature, and performing arts. He studied at the École Internationale du Théâtre Jacques Lecoq in 1996 and joined LISPA in 2011, where he completed the Advanced Devising Practice Program as well as the pedagogical training. An active collaborator with companies in the U.S., Europe, and Latin America, he also holds a Ph.D. in Modern Languages and Literatures from the University of Miami, with an emphasis on performance. His dissertation, Scenic Landscapes, the Theater in the Global City, explores the relation between globalization, theater, and non-conventional performance spaces. In this interview, Ariel riffs on the theme of horizontal and vertical arrangements, situating theater making in relation to intellectual and political movements, particularly in Europe and Latin America. He talks about how these arrangements show up for theater in its process, its housing, funding, and survival, and in the structure of the educational institutions where theater making is learned sometimes. And for actors, he comes from a perspective that places embodied play first and foremost in a way I find very pleasurable, and I hope you do too. I've tried to list in the accompanying notes the many artists and philosophers mentioned here for those wishing to dig deeper. I hope you enjoy listening to Ariel as much as I did. The first question I want to ask has to do with the image of people standing in a circle who have gathered to do some kind of collaborative activity and what your relationship is to this image. I imagine you begin your classes that way, although I studied with you on Zoom, so we were not in a circle. And so I guess I'm curious, is that your experience too? Is that how you begin working with a group of people to collaborate on theater making?
Well, not necessarily. And I think, where did you see this image?
From my experience, from whether it's walking in for a first time and meeting other members of a play and you gather around the table to read, to any kind of acting class that begins with some kind of exercise. So usually there's a warm up where everyone can see each other and there's some sort of exercise. So to me, in a way, it's the place where it begins, where everyone can see each other.
No, I was just asking because I thought that you were referring to a very specific image. It's a very specific image of the Odin Theatre, led by Eugenio Barba, taken in Peru in the 70s. And this is basically that. But yes, it's basically a community and everybody's kind of gathering in a big circle in the mountains of Cusco, where, you know, the old temple of Machu Picchu is in Peru, in the Andes.
Right. And perfect. That's beautiful. So what describe what
this image is. I thought this is what you meant when you asked me.
That's great. I love this.
Back to your question, if you ask me if I start my work in theater making like this. No, not necessarily. I look at people in the face. I look at them in their eyes. The configuration is irrelevant. Of course, it's great, you know, if you just have a group of people say, can we come in a circle? I introduce myself because just the circle is a bit useful. I get to know normally the people that I'm working with in between spaces. That's how you get to know the work of the people. It's not in the space only. It's in the dressing rooms. It's in the breaks. It's when they smoke a cigarette outside and they're talking to others. That's them, you see? And of course, then there's another persona that comes into a group of participants. And those are the ones who will make the group, 10, 15 people, whatever, 20. But yes, normally if I have a group of 20 people, I just stand and people are around and I just say my name and I want to know who they are. I want to hear their name. And it's not so much about them explaining, oh, this is like if you say, I'm Noah and I do this and I do this and I do that. It's more like for me just to get to have a temperature. And I have to say, in those very first informal or formal minutes of a meeting, a lot happens. Sometimes you hear the name, the way they say their names, the way language operates, how important language is or not. Sometimes it's about the gaze, something that you see already. And of course, most people don't pay attention to the feet when they're standing. And I look at people's feet, not because I want to see something, because for me, it matters, the contact with the floor. Thinking with the feet, it's important for me, not with your head. Not with the head, I mean, not only with the neocortex part of the brain that follows a certain logic, but it's more understanding what is it that you are doing. Are you standing on the floor, on the ground, in relationship to others? So there's a spatial relationship that your feet can go forward or back or sideways. It's very concrete. What your feet are doing will determine what your body does. And if you don't have feet, and if you kneel, then it's your knees. So your contact with the ground. Yeah. So for me, those first moments are super, super important. I remember this past, just like a short memory, an anecdote. This summer, I worked with a group of people from all over the world, and there was a lady from Japan. And when it was her turn to say, "Hello, this is my name. I'm from Japan." And I asked them, you know, "Why do you come here?" And she said, "I'm interested in the work. I found it interesting because I dance and I do theater and whatnot. And I want to change my life," she said. Okay. And so, of course, you know, I say, great. And that is what you bring as an expectation. And it's great that you bring that expectation. You understand that it may not happen. Huh? It may not happen in a week. Sometimes we meet for a couple of weeks to work, to train. And
in devising?
It is always, not devising in particular. It had to do with applied embodiment. You have to devise. You must devise always. Devise is different than just let's get together with others in a room to create something. Devising is also how to process each idea that you have as a creator and the process of transposition of that idea into an embodied version of it. That you need to do all the time on your own. So it's a constant self-devising process where you bring material into a space that later on begins to interact with all the material in a disjointed or jointed manner to be seen. But I remember saying, I mean, to her, look, you know, it's great that you have a great expectation and you bring that. And it may not happen, just like Beckett said, it may never happen. Or that you're ready for it to happen because it can happen in a moment. It can happen in a moment and you need to be ready for it. Because changing your life can be very moving and very unsettling. Could be very happy eventually. But one thing is to say, that's what I want. Another thing is to be ready and available for that to happen. And I think that's key. You know, it's like when we talk to device, and it's a place where we come to be available. You might say available for what? For nothing. For nothing. Just like Francis Bacon will say, I'm optimistic about nothing. Of course, he's joking. But to be available with others, that's enough.
Yes.
I'm available. Available, open, creatively, intellectually. I'm available to play. Great. Mm-hmm. Then what could happen? So the geometry of the initial formation is circular, and not necessarily because it is a circle. It functions like a circle. Certain circles don't want to be circles. Certain circles want to be squares, and other circles demand to be a triangle, very hierarchical. Sometimes groups don't want to be groups. They want to be other things. And if you're a leader of one of those groups, you have to interpret that very quickly. You know that if you're proposing something that is not vertical, it's not top down, and a group is asking for that verticality, you also need to play a game with them, meaning you adopt a momentary verticality, which is totally ungrounded. It's for them. It's not for you. So how to do that? How to be a leader if you don't believe in verticality? But a group needs that sometimes. So the utopia or the idea of having something more horizontal or even diagonal is great, I would say. Like Mayer Hall will propose a horizontal theater. But one also needs to understand the desires and the needs of the group of human beings in front of you. Because the group is like a kid. They will always be demanding a certain structure. Even if they don't say it out loud, the group will always enter a symptomatic behavior because there's a particular structure that each group needs, and it's very different. It's like a family. It is like a family.
It's like a family. Yes. And you, and your role, partially anyway, is to discern what the group is silently requesting in terms of if it's a verticality or if it's to split into subgroups or.
I mean, I come with a proposal, and the proposal is always based on play. My role is to play. I don't take it that serious. If you take it that serious, then don't lose your sense of humor because you'll be very disappointed. And then in the spirit of play, I come with a proposal and a form. But the form is not fixed, meaning if you need to be more vertical, then we can establish that verticality, understanding that it's just one way of doing it, and there might be other ways of doing it. This discernment you talk about is nothing that you do before the work. It's in the work. In play, you might propose different approaches, and then you ask the person, which one do you prefer? Oh, I like this one because it gives me a frame. Great. But why do you need that? So then the group begins to voice preferences. At the same time, my role is to show that there's more than one or two or three ways of doing things. So it's not that there's a way to do it. It's a way that you choose to do it. And that's very different. So it's always shared responsibility. It's a shared responsibility. This is very important to say, I'm responsible. You are responsible. If you are not on time and I am on time, the agreement is off. For example, there's always a taking full responsibility for what I'm bringing and what I'm asking. Yes. And so, so in this interaction, we begin to find sort of the parameters that will be more creative and more constructive for our constellation, however long that is. And I think that's the beginning of collaborative work. To collaborate also means to share the cost, to share the cost, the emotional cost of the work.
Yeah. Mm. How would you describe the difference, if you could characterize it generally, maybe you can't, between a group that you work with for 1 week and what is the longest in terms of a group that knows each other very well and has worked together a long time?
2 years. 2 or 2.5, Monday to Friday, 6, 7, 8, 10 hours a day. Yeah.
You've also worked with theater companies though, right? Mm-hmm. No longer than 2 years together though. Like an established company where they might have members of long standing?
No, I work with theater companies that work together 55 years. I wasn't 55 years with them, but they, like the Odin Theater in Holstebro, Denmark, directed by Eugenio Barba. You know, Eugenio Barba was Jerzy Grotowski's assistant in Poland. And then he created the Odin. He founded the Odin in 1966 in Oslo. And after a short stay, they moved to Denmark. And so since 66, they are together. And some of them are still in the company today. And they are 80 years old. Yeah, they are. And they work, they live in communities. They created that. And yes, of course, people come and go. And some people have remained part of that original agreement. So yes, I have worked with the Odin, in the Odin as well. Recurringly, I find it probably one of the most solid theater laboratories in Europe for many years. For some people, the notion of theater laboratories is outdated, exhausted, old. Many people may have aesthetic reasons for it. They might say their work is not so interesting. That, why not? You know, one could buy into that. I think there's also a predominance to not understand or to not be able to relate directly with the persistence, you know, and the resilience of a group of individuals that over time remain doing this for 30, 40, 50 years. So that you might not like what that group of people do. Nonetheless, it's really rare to stick together for that long nowadays.
When you're working with them, in what capacity are you working with them?
Well, with them, I've done what they call cohabitation. Cohabitation, we live together. We go to a monastery in Italy, the whole company and a group of other people who express interest in having this period together. Sometimes you can be together for 10 days. Sometimes you can be together for 6 weeks.
And it's entirely process. It's not oriented toward a production or an outcome?
Both. Some of these things end up with a production. There's work and you devise and you show work at national theaters and stuff. I would be careful with the use of the word process, because it feels like there's a dichotomy between process and product,
yeah,
which I don't think is very conducive, right, sometimes, because what is process?
Yeah.
And what is product? One could say, if I have a commission, I have a product to deliver. Yes, but that will presuppose a process. A process of creating a production in 6 weeks is a process.
Mm-hmm.
Some people might say, but I need my process when you don't have a deadline, like the theater industry mentality, and then one can delve, right? One can jump into the ocean of experimentation for long, long periods. Is that what process is? To have long periods of searching for things? And then, because this is important, at least to establish. I like the idea of process. What do we mean by that?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, a few things I'm thinking of. One is this notion, Joan Littlewood talked about bringing the play home. So there would be a phase of experiment and play. But in order to perform, there's another period where it becomes more of a reality that imagines sharing with an audience, and that's a different period for the work. Then another thing that comes to mind is the idea of divergent thinking, which is more full of possibilities, versus convergent thinking, which is more starting to make choices that are going to put guardrails or framework or something like this. I'm making like dough making bread with my hands. And that those two things, I guess, can merge and blur, but also that they're different one from the other, right?
Yes, they're different ones. They're different. I think if you work with a director, that's the director's job. If that's what you establish, you know, we generate material, and then one day we'll say, up to now, we generated material. Great. Then we enter the phase of montage. Great. So we select of all the material we generated as a group. So what do? We choose this, that, and then we just need to begin to put it together. And then that is still process.
Yes.
Because you say, let's put it in this order, 1 to 10, and then it doesn't work so well. Yeah, part of process is that, you know, in a way, it's a different type of process, I would say. I mean, You say divergent and convergent when you begin to frame. But even when you begin to frame, something is interesting that happens to the material. You generate material, you say, we're going to use this material, whatever the material is. Sure. And one can think of the material as a thing independently, right? Then the very fact that you put it in relationship, once again, like human beings in relationship with another thing, immediately what happens is that there's a rhythmical relationship. Oh, they relate rhythmically or they don't. Right. So they begin to go. Yeah, I mean, I think this one comes before this one thematically, but it's completely off rhythmically. So it cannot be like this thematically, because it doesn't work. So we need to invert the order. Great. And it begins not to make sense thematically, but it doesn't matter, because then you begin to process differently to go, oh, I need to reprocess everything in relationship to understand the sequence. And then you end up with a sequence in your hand that you never thought that you will have for the very nature of the material. So you continue to process and process and process and process something that has been done before. So you sort of distill it and distill. So this constant distillation. And then I could say, Noah, the product is ready tomorrow or next week, opening night or opening day. Sure. And I would say, no, the opening day is just a decision where the studio opens, audience come, we do the ritual, and they begin to see the state of affairs. This is where we are. And then 1 week of run through and another two, and then the play runs for 2, 3, 4, 6 weeks. And we continue to understand that, it keeps changing. And of course, it doesn't change. The structure remains. But everything, as you know, is beginning to be oiled, and we find adjustments and playfulness and meaning. And we always thought that the strongest part was on the second part of the play, and then we realized, no, it's actually the third part of the piece. Oh, and so then we continue to process. So that's what I mean by processing, to go, So we all understand what product means, but we also understand that There's a constant negotiation through material, especially when we devise. We devise. If you don't devise and you're a director who has professional actors, I think it's still the same. You might not, the director might not say, hey, you know, I think the piece is ready, and then it's running like a clock. And you still need to talk to your cast and have a talk. So yes, the process, when we get together with this group, sometimes we do research, purely research. We train. We start the days at 7 a.m. and we finish the day at 11 p.m. And it's like, we do everything together. We live together. We eat together. We have teams for cooking, teams for cleaning. And unless everything is clean, nobody's in the rehearsal room. And that's just the rules. And then we do physical movement for 4 or 5 hours in the morning. Then we eat. Then we work a bit in the theater, like cleaning and sometimes painting or whatever we need to do. And then we go to rehearsals in the evening or in the afternoon. And or maybe if it's not rehearsals, just practical sessions where we apply a principle and we work on that thing for 2 weeks or 3 weeks, just one thing. So that is one way of this cohabitation.
Give an example of that. That's interesting. 2 or 3 weeks on one principle.
One movement, 3 weeks.
One movement. Yeah. A movement as a section or a movement as a gesture?
You decide. A movement could be a gesture. A gesture is made out of many movements. Normally we will work with a movement score. Uh-huh. So it's a score. So a score is a sequence of movements. Each one of these movements linked together with the other ones create a sequence. That's what we call score, like a music score. Then, of course, the difference between a movement and an action is the motivation underneath or behind. Once you understand your intention for a movement, the movement becomes an action. Otherwise, I'm just moving forward. I'm not going to get the coffee. Yeah? You could see that there's a score of movements, and underneath there's a score of intentions, what I would call the sub-score. And this score, it's very clear, and you can repeat it. So then we know what the movement base is. Once we understand the movement, that we don't have to think anymore, what am I doing? What is next? We can play with a movement. Because otherwise we improvise and we can never repeat. You remember something that you can number 1, 2, 3, 15. And you can do it as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 to 15. But somebody can say, can we do the other way around? 15, 14, 13, 12. Or can you do 4, 5, 6, 7? Or can we change 7 and put in number 2? And then it's like 1, 7, 3, 5, 9, 8. And so, okay, then we deconstruct the movement and we reformulate. So that's the work of memory. You dismember something in order to remember something. I personally work like this. For me, when I work in embodied memory, that's one of the things I propose always to the group, to say it's important to dismember something. It's important to deconstruct. Now people use the word deconstruct. You can also remember. When you remember, you rebuild differently. That's the way we access emotions and memories. Because if we don't dismember something, sometimes it's too hard for human beings to access memory as it is. Memory is only accessed through suppression sometimes, or through partial remembering. And so you go, oh, it's interesting. You might tell the same story again and again and again so many times. And every time you're shifting something. And sometimes you go, the memory might not be like this entirely, but I like to tell it like this. So then it's about the storyteller sometimes. It's not just about the memory. Two things fused together, two scores fused together. What happened? This is the fact. 1, 2, 3, 15. The intention. And sometimes the intention fuses so much that you can't recognize which is which, who is who, and say, oh. So all of a sudden it looks natural. It doesn't look naturalistic. It feels like a second nature thing. It's like, oh, how do we get there? Like that. All of a sudden you just feel like there are not two things. It's just one. It can turn into anything. Sometimes you don't even recognize any trace of the original movement score in the final thing. What is important is that this work on this versatility of the score gives you the possibility to understand step by step all the possibilities that you might have around a line. And then you can work technically on it. You can work emotionally on it. You can work with costumes. You can create music. You can have text. You can equate text to action. You can divorce text from action. You can breathe when you speak, or you can breathe out and then you move. There are a million ways to work with it. But that will be an example of taking, for example, the notion of a physical score. And you can approach the score from four or five different perspectives. You can work with sticks and use scores. You can work with Kathakali dance from India, which is super codified. That's all the oriental theater is scores. Bhuto, Kabuki, No, the Peking Opera, a lot of martial arts, Balinese masks. If you see the way they move, it's all based on score. You can do that, but you can also say, we're going to here get together to talk about the Holocaust, images of Holocaust. All right. So we can start from the Bible on, if you want. So what is the Holocaust? And then here we go. That's a whole different approach. Eventually, we'll end up doing a movement score, even if we don't talk about it. We can improvise from emotion, from memories. We can do so many things. But this getting together for longer periods sometimes have different reasons. One is sometimes to explore on a topic. Two is to explore on techniques, meaning if we work on an international ensemble, which is the work that I do mostly, where do we meet? What are principles of movement or principles on stage where actors from the East and West could meet? Is it in the anatomy of the body? Is it in the impulses? Is it in the way the body works with balance and off balances? If you look at Commedia dell'arte, 16th century performers with the mask, they have a particular way. If you look at the Harlequin, Pulcinella, Dottore, the way they are drawn, and then you begin to look at drawings of Asian characters from 19th century, and they're similar. So there's a physicality where we all meet. So it is interesting to say we meet through principles, but that requires also sometimes going to these international schools of theater anthropology for 2, 3, 4 weeks. Back in the 80s when they started these meetings, I think the first one was in Brazil and the second one was in Germany, in Bonn. And that was a 60-day long meeting. And it was wonderful for 60 days. Then, of course, people didn't have 60 days anymore. Now we meet for 2 weeks or three. That will be principles sometimes. That will be scores. That will be topics. Other times it's just to say we meet to create a piece. Sure. So everybody has to bring material. And so then most of the job is not that you're going to devise with others. You devise on your own. And then we do a collective devising of all the material presented. All of that requires time in the space. You see?
The way you describe it, it's that you are tuning into who has shown up and who is there and what are they bringing to figure out how you're going to work. Is that far or very close to how you trained with Jacques Lecoq?
No, that wasn't the Lecoq training. No.
No.
For me, at least. I mean, I trained with Lecoq in 96 and Lecoq was a teacher, you know? I will go to Grotowski's classes on Monday nights as well of theater anthropology. He will talk, Grotowski, for 6 or 7 hours nonstop.
Wow.
At the Théâtre de l'Odéon, he will smoke and sometimes he had a can of Coca-Cola that he would just roll on a table. And he will talk for 6 hours. And then he will stop around midnight. I say, we continue next time. And then 2 weeks later, we met again at 6 p.m. or 7. And he will take it from the word he left it and carry on another 6 hours. What I did learn at the Lecoq School somehow was, it was an introduction to, I mean, now I'm looking back, you know, it's, I was invited to interact with non-logical concepts. For example, go to nature, observe the sea, or he will send me to the zoo. 3 weeks, every morning, pick one animal, the panther I picked. 3 weeks, observing every day a panther. Then one day I go to the studio and I become the panther I observe. I start kind of miming it. Yes? Of course, through the movement of my body, I can begin to evoke the panther, the details. But then this movement-based evocation or memory slowly turns into a mental state, or I would say into a performative state, which is a very animalistic state, which Merleau-Ponty, you know, the French philosopher, will develop, or Henri Bergson with matter and memory, you know, early 1920s, and Merleau-Ponty, philosophy of perception, mm-hmm. on animal states. Then it's not that I'm just mimicking a panther. I am the panther. Momentarily, I am. I become. I become the ocean I'm observing. I am. I see I am. That's the neutral mask. The body, mm-hmm. for the first time, I'm looking at a tree, but the tree is also looking at me back. What a wonderful thing for a performer. What a wonderful thing. I'm being also looked by a tree. Sure. So then we have a dialogue. It's a different type of dialogue. So then the Lecoq school was a space to understand spatial configuration of things, embodiment of elements, embodiment of music, embodiment of architecture, of poetry, everything through the body, everything running through the body, through the body, through the body. No talking, no talking, no reading, no discussion, no answers. They will not explain to you. But having said this, the system was rather vertical, meaning there was a way of doing things. And in the 80s and 90s, it was a great age of technicians. So we were all expected to execute or reproduce as close to the origin as possible. Sure, that is great. Yeah, we have that. Now, in Denmark, with Barba, I began to see the work of an ensemble, which is different than in Lecoq. Yeah? Nonetheless, generationally speaking, Barba and Lecoq belong to a similar generation. Barba was still holding the lead very vertically, very vertically. So when we started our project in London and later on in Berlin, and our project started being a Lecoq-based project because we were trained there in Paris.
This is LISPA.
Yeah, that was LISPA. Slowly, slowly, we say, yeah, we are 20 years this year. What will be a project where there's no more that voice that congregates, that organizes, that decides things? And of course, the utopia of the full horizontality was not possible neither. Why was it not possible? Because of time. You need a lot of time to embody horizontality. And as we know, and as I know, because I do work with geometries in the space, a horizontal line is not horizontal. And a square doesn't move like a square. Keep that in mind. Something that looks very vertical could be very horizontal if it's well done. And so then it takes a long time for that to work, to say, let's change the roles, let's change leadership. What is divisive? How long can you go or can you work without knowing, really? When is the moment that people say, we need a director? We need to know what we're doing. All of these things.
You've come very naturally to where I was hoping you would go next, which is you were holding your hands as if you were holding a staff vertically, and you moved it horizontally, and then you moved your hands around, just describing what can't be seen. And then that opens these questions of from vertically organizing the ensemble to horizontally, how is the shaping process going to happen? And that's a function of time. And when it's horizontal and everyone is contributing these ideas, I want to say the word mess. It's a bit of a mess, or it's definitely very full, a very full, very ripe situation that's going to take a lot of time. So that question emerges, who is the director and how does the decision-making process occur?
I think also this is what I was going when you say, did I learn that in Lecoq? No, I learned that in Latin America. And I didn't learn that in theater. I learned that in society. Western Europe and even United States and some other places in the world work through a certain mindset. And in this mindset, the element of urgency, sometimes it isn't present. The urgency means what Tadeusz Kantor had in Nazi-occupied Poland. He was in France and he said, I'm going back. And he was rehearsing with his company in these rooms. You can watch the dead class. I mean, it's online. You were not allowed to do these type of things. to rehearse. He will even say, one day we are rehearsing, we hear a knock on the door, Cantor, Tadeusz Cantor, this is 1940s, in Krakow, a German general, a soldier come in, they open the door and here it is. And he's there in the door and he stares at them. They don't say a word. There's not a word being said. And they close the door. And ever since that day, they kept a young girl at the doorstep, just in case they were like, and then they will say that sometimes they will congregate around the curtain and they will open the curtain and they could hear the executions in the distance. Mm. People are being shot 100 meters away of you and you are rehearsing. What? The magnitude of that is one urgency, extreme. Dictatorships, censorships, economic collapses, constant uncertainty. Today, as we speak, Argentina is into presidential elections. The annual inflation for us was 140% just this year. Mm. 140. For a moment, think about your life with 140% of inflation over 9 months, just to understand what your life will look like. With that being said, socially speaking, what Latin America or being from there has taught me is me and many. And Eugenio Barba, for example, always agrees that the seed of ensemble blossom in Latin America for him is the first place of cooperatives, the idea of collective creation. I don't do it for the money. You don't do it for the money. We're going to work and become professional, but most people will get the sources to support this from somewhere else. At the end of the day, 7, 8 p.m., when you finish work, that's when you go to the theater. You begin classes. Classes in South America start at 7 p.m. or 7:30 once you finish work, and they run to midnight. And then you have to go home and have dinner, and then the next day you go to work, hopefully. Why do we do this will be a question. What is the motivation for doing it? It's not for the fame, neither. If I bring money from my job and you bring money from your job, yes, money that we need, as somebody else also brings money and somebody else also brings money, we all own the process. You see, the stakes are clear. Everybody's fully invested on whatever. So we respect the world because it's our time and our money. There's no idea of like, do I get subsidies? Do I get funding? Do I have a space? No, I don't have a space. So what do we rehearse? We rehearse in some school. It's cold. There are people running. That is what I learned. The notion of collective. There's a sense of collective in Latin America and a sense of collective in Europe, which is very different. It's not better or worse. But I will say, I think in Latin America, due to its social historical nature and the histories of those countries, and you learn after dictatorships and brutality to find more egalitarian systems, whatever that means. So it's the result of a lot of pain, I would say, socially. That was the experience closer to horizontality, I would say. While in Europe, the concept of horizontality was always very attractive. In the 80s, I would say, or the 90s, and even the 70s, I think the 70s probably closer to May 68 in Paris and that intellectual revolution, the utopia was very close. I think people felt it was possible to say, we can't live in something more horizontal. We can stay away from this Cartesian, hierarchical, classist-based system which Europe embodies. And that's what Europe is, Noah. And I wouldn't generalize, but if we need to speak very frankly, all the neo-fascisms that emerged in the past 5, 8, 10 years, and nowadays everybody's in Congress in their respective countries, is nothing else but the result of this. Sectarian, homogeneous, ignorant in a way, classist, hierarchical ideas of society made up and costumed with this maquillage for so many decades of a very attractive intellectual and artistic progressismo. Now I will say, oh, great. Sounds so open. It sounds so this and that and that and that. And then you scratch the surface and here you have France, Italy, you name it. Some countries don't mind. Hungary and Poland, they don't mind to be on the extreme right. They never try to hide it. But the other countries try to sell the world this idea of things are more fair, equal, and there's social justice, and yeah. Sure, to a certain extent. But this sense of collective of the photo I show you, that is the 70s. It's not the 90s. It's not the 2000, but the Odin Theatret, like many others say, on that spirit of the 70s, or the, on the spirit of the neutral math, we hold 55 years together. And from outside, it's a super nice utopia. When you go inside, of course, there was a lot of unfair things happening. It wasn't so horizontal. It wasn't so ideal. And I know this also because of experience, and I know from firsthand examples, not just about the Odin, but in general, I'm not talking about the Odin per se, the dysfunctionality of horizontality as well, right? So I just wanted to bring that into the conversation to say it's a great possibility to not be vertical and be more horizontal, but it's not necessarily constructive always. I think one needs to understand when it's time to be more vertical, diagonal, horizontal, circular, triangular. When I teach younger people to say, if you want to be a divisor, then you need to be ready. Ready for what? I did an exercise a few weeks ago, and I said, bring five objects, only five. And some of them say, can we bring some more? And I say, if you want. I mean, of course, you can have 500. But you know what? You need to be able to reach down your pocket with five objects and put together in the space the foundational layer of the whole production and explain it to somebody. This is what the piece is. This is what it looks like. This is the image. That's the topic. That's the variation. That's how we create a montage. With what? With five objects that I just found randomly. So then, yes, then you have to be prepared to have all the funding in the world and not to have any. Rutovsky would say, back to the poor theater as well. Of course, the poor theater of Rutovsky was not based on poverty. He was subsidized for 30 years. See, that's the difference. I can also go into a theater laboratory with long periods of exploration and Grotowski say, I don't want audience anymore. I don't do theater for audiences anymore. Yes, but the Polish government was subsidizing him for 30 years or 20. Then he moved to America. He went to Irvine in California and Richard Schechner brought him to New York and Grotowski's company was in the U.S., not because he was interested in American culture, and he never said it like this. He was interested in the funding that the American institutions were providing him so he could continue to do his thing. Super fine. Like the School of Frankfurt during the Nazi occupation. Adorno and Horkheimer, all those people moved to the U.S. and they established their school in there. They continued to produce intellectual work, not Walter Benjamin. That was a different reality back in the days of Second World War. But I think you and I also can say, hey, we are funded for the next 10 years. And we're going to go into long processes. Yes, but then to be Marxist, we need to look at the mode of production and the conditions of work. So what are the conditions of work and how do they determine the nature of the work in the space? Eugenio Barba and the Odin Theatret for 40 years, I would say, or a bit less. They were heavily subsidized by the Danish government. So a lot of the income came from the Danish government in return of certain social services. You can even read in the biography of the Odin, Barba say, for the first 10 years, nobody understood a thing we were doing. And I was just telling people, you just need to give us time. 10 years of work, very few people in the town went to see what these foreigners were doing. Very strange type of theater. Nobody understood anything. Eventually, Barba succeeded in bringing this very small town in Denmark to the world. So the world of theater went to Denmark for this space. What I'm trying to say is that the financial conditions of existence, the way they worked, are very different than the situation nowadays, where we don't have 5, 10, 15-year subsidies that will enable us to say, do you know, the nature of my work is very horizontal and process-based. Well, that sounds fantastic. But who finances this? Well, the government does. Sure. But, I mean, and sometimes this is not being said like this because it doesn't sound so nice. But I think it is important that it's not about mystery. Some groups have this aura of myth around them. And it's like, how did they manage? If you do have a salary and you make your efforts and you have secure subsidies or whatever, or income from your patrons, probably a process, a long process-oriented experience is more doable and feasible. But for the majority of people, that isn't the case. Art House, LISPA, has never been subsidized. Not once. Not 1 euro. We never ask any government for anything. So we predominantly work with the people who come to work with us. So this idea of horizontality or something more oblique it's a longer conversation, Noah, because I mean, for so many years, that was sort of the alma mater of our project. And then there were decisions that I didn't share and I didn't make myself, but we needed to make them to survive, apparently, because, you know, funding. Well, we need to make deals with institutions now. So some universities that were degree granting established agreements with us. So the students come to us and then they get a degree from a university in England or a university in the United States, for example. And then you say, oh, great. So that means that every year you're going to get 10 students from them. Technically and theoretically, you say, oh, I secure my sustainability for the years to come. Well, that's not true, especially because pre-pandemic, the situation started to decline. Post-pandemic was a disaster. The paradigm is shifting. But the reality is that once you make an agreement with an institution, your agenda is being set from an office in some institution that is far away from you, and they're telling you how to go about. To which I say, as a freelancer, no. In my sessions, I decide. You don't like it, that's your problem. We don't negotiate, but we do. So again, sometimes I try to be more horizontal, and sometimes the market is demanding less horizontality. And believe it or not, if you're not more vertical in the way you present your work, super traditional A, B, C, D, lots of people don't buy. A lot of people will not sign up for this because they might find that it's not super clear what I'm going to learn, how am I going to use it, the applicability of the things being learned, techniques. And if you tell them, you're not going to learn any technique, you're not going to come here to learn all of this that you can get in an ABCD program, you're going to have an experience. If you just say that, lots of people will say, I don't know if I'm going to spend 500 euros doing that. The construction of the discourse is super vertical. And then you try to be less vertical than the discourse. And a lot of people will like, but when I signed to the workshop, it say this, this, and this. Huh? How about this?
Yeah.
So then here we go again. That's what I say. A horizontal line is not horizontal because we live in a time where a lot of people criticize and reject this. Again, the fascist, the super vertical structure. And the same people who criticize that in a different manner are asking for verticality in their work. So they can make sense of the world. Yeah. And this is unconscious. If we were in 1971 or 72 at the time of the Grateful Dead in America, hey, who cares about verticality? It was about collective. Let's go. Let's go to Woodstock. Let's follow Dylan and let's try it all. And that was the time of the collective, of the circle, of the let's just experiment. And then 25 minutes music tracks. The record companies will not say 3 minutes, it needs to sell. So they were bottling up things differently in the 70s. Nowadays, when you bring this idea of group, collectivity, horizontality, either is outdated, it's sentimental, a bit nostalgic, or they cannot bridge the usefulness of that to the world we live in at the moment, which is quite brutal. But if I take that to a different realm, which is the theatrical genres in history, for example, the space of commedia dell'arte is the horizontal. Commedia exists in a temporality which is horizontal, hence is quick. Tragedy is a different story. The fate is decided for you. So the vertical appears. For the first time, the vertical appears. The gods are the ones on top. No matter what you do, we as an audience member know your fate. That was the whole sinister game of tragedy. The audience knew that the heroine or the hero will be gone. The interest was more, how long is it going to take? So when you read Medea, she held on. Wow. Everybody goes, what a tragedy. Others didn't hold on so long. So then for the first time in the vertical, you look up to the gods. And then in history, the Middle Ages will come. And in theater, for the first time, we or the human also begins to look down through the earth, down underneath. That's Shakespeare. First time ever where we are no longer talking about our relationship to the gods. Shakespeare's brilliance is that for the first time he's talking about human greed. He brings the politics from heaven down to us. Greed, the king, what you have, what I have, what I want. the misery, vengeance, revenge, really, really low feelings, you see, away from morality, away from the church, away from all of this, not the church, but I'm seeing the church in the sense of the morale. It's not about that anymore. It's about exploring kind of the depth of human misery as well. And of course, Shakespeare is really funny, but that's where the buffons appear, the buffon as a genre. The buffon is the inverted vertical. You don't look up, you look down. And the buffon, that's the whole kind of like dark cycle, kind of the Nazi journey down. In movement, that will be an undulation that goes forward, but I need to show you the space. And the counter undulation is the movement of the buffon as a genre. In other words, we go to the mythical, the underground. And that is the vertical in the history of theater when you construct. So that's a transposition. So what does the vertical mean? Well, once again, we go into either we are ruled by the gods or the semi-gods of the Greek tragedy, or we are ruled by the gods or the semi-gods of human misery. Damn. And the buffon does the whole cycle and tries to escape from it. He tries to laugh at the king. He tries to mock the king, which was the representative of God. And he also tries to mock death underneath. One theatrical figure that would escape the geometry of power, the social geometry of power. So we work with this actually in our matrix. So our students will go through the discovery of the world, as I say, the resonance with nature, to eventually move to a more human relationship. Once you embody the ocean or the mountain, then I can look at you in your eyes and for the first time see not a mountain, but a human being. And I can relate with you horizontally, jokingly, or we can relate to each other with more distance, so conflict.
It seems to me that Shakespeare also introduced that, more characters, more interrelationships, less
higher. And he also wrote a lot for actors. The geometry, this is what I did learn in Lecoq, the geometry of the space has a correlation with the geometry of genres in theater history. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to creating a collaborative project, the geometry also has a repercussion in the way groups function.
Yeah.
For example, a group can have buffon or several buffons.
Ah.
A group will be quite horizontal, which is short-lived. Short. But horizontal. You could also have the tragic structure of the group, where if you push it poetically, one could say, once upon a time, we depended on a head. Yes, we depended on the boss. And now we just feel like orphans, like lost orphans on an infinite quest for reference. That's Beckett. What a wonderful way of being tragic without being extremely vertical. So up in the top, it's vacant. Nobody. Wow. So what do we do now? A world with no God. Is that possible? No, it isn't. It isn't because there's nothing to go against or to go with or to go for. So then that reveals the nature of human beings. You need to go against each other sometimes, either to worship the same thing or to fight about the same thing that we worship. Now, in the absence of leadership, here we look at each other and we begin to create conflicts with each other to see who will take the place of the one in the top. That is why the verticality is necessary to avoid self-destructive models. You need to understand, in the state of the buffon, that you need to be a buffon leader, so then the space of the leader is taken, so then people don't turn self-destructive. If you ask me philosophically, I wouldn't agree with that. And then I wouldn't agree neither with this idea of the social contract by Rousseau, that in nature we are all villains and we are all evil and we're going to destroy each other. So we need to have a social contract that will legislate upon our behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe in essence, I'm more anarchist in the sense of it's a self-driven and self-determined notion of power that has all the type of repercussions as well. Yes, but I think when it comes to devised theater collaborative projects, our responsibility as artists also is to interpret the world as it's moving. And instead of creating an island to escape or to go against, we need to create a frame that dialogues with the uncertainty and beauty and brutality of today. We need to create a frame also from within that is in connection with this, so we avoid being A, doctrinary, it's like a little sect, 2, so idealistic that it's not grounded anywhere. And then, of course, if we're a group of 15 people and we all are rich, then maybe we can afford that momentarily. But in the long term, we're not doing ourselves a favor. We need to create a system where we look at the outside world and say, the world is the way it is. We collaborate the way we collaborate in response to this. So then to go back to this idea of being Marxist, we don't lose contact with the ground, the feet in the ground. What is the reality? What are the conditions of work? What is our daily reality? And from there, we can create. Or at least that's the way I am interested in creating.
Right. So you've really brought us right to the place where I wanted to go with that, which is back to this idea of, do we actually need a director? And let's say we're collaborating in a horizontal way, and I'm in a group of people who want to do that.
What would be a director for you? You say, do we need a director? What would be the director's role? You say, do we need a director? I would say, you need an outside eye for sure.
The question was posed by you earlier when you were talking about, you know, when you move like this to the horizontal position, a question arises of, do we need a director, and how are these decisions to get made? So I guess I'm trying to envision how you, is the process of starting to shape the material something that you facilitate for people in an embodied way, or do you get them to talk about?
No talking.
So it's an embodied experience.
Yeah. You know, in a room when you move for a while, you know the bodies that can hold dramatic tension. You know who can take Hamlet on their shoulders. Not because they are better. It's not about that. It's a particular way of being present in the space that can hold these marathons. While other people are super good for 100 meters, you need both. You need the sprinters that are super fast, and you need the other one who will run the 42 kilometers. Because the one that runs the 42 kilometers is the one that holds the illusion of time for us. Tick, 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 tick. Every time you look around, they're running. Mm-hmm. So time is passing. Life is passing. So there's an urgency to arrive, and there's also an urgency to do things before the end. Hopefully we'll make it to the end. While the other ones who run faster is the fun events. Yeah? The small events. So some bodies in the group are sprinters, and some bodies in the group are long-term runners. That's the first thing you get into a group. And it's not that you like it or you don't. You can see. And sometimes you have more than one, but normally you don't have so many. The second thing that you realize is that some people have a sense of musicality in the space and others don't. When the rhythm is off, the rhythm is off. There isn't much discussion about it. You go, that's dissonant. How come? Yeah. Well, listen. Din, 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 din. That's dissonant. Sure. So some people do come with a knowledge, for example, of music and rhythms and harmony. Those people naturally become musical directors of a company.
I guess the question I'm wanting to ask has to do with an important role of the dissonant person in the room, the one that doesn't have the musicality, and their role in the ensemble.
That's the antagonistic.
Yeah.
That's the person that creates the off balance. Which is great, because the Lecoq principle says the fixed point is always moving. The fixed point on stage is always moving. So if you look at Ariane Mouchkine, the whole Théâtre du Soleil, 50 years, they construct scenes on these trolleys that they push. Yeah? So they're always in the move, always moving. So the dissonant and the antagonistic is important if they are dissonant in relationship. Dissonance per dissonance sake is not so interesting, because you need to mask dissonance. If you don't mask it, if it's not part of a mask, and by a mask, I mean a construction.
Earlier, you said the mask is I see and then I am.
No, that's the neutral mask. That's the neutral mask.
That's the neutral mask, right. Okay, so masking in devising and performance.
Yeah.
As I understand, is the space between
the performer and the construction.
The performer and the construction, and that space is necessary for the audience to enter in.
Yes, to imagine, to play, to project, and it's necessary for you to breathe as well. Yes.
Mm-hmm. For you to dream, for the audience to dream with you.
Yes, yes, yes. So if you mask your dissonance, so if it's playful, then it will live through the dramaturgy. If you ask me, do we need a director when we do things? I think we do. Yes, I think we do. The role of a director or of a leader is such that, in my understanding, at least in devising, that's the way I also direct. I did a show in Stockholm in May. Yeah. We arrived to the theater and they had, I remember when we met, they had a vague idea of what is it that we were doing, but they all wanted to be there. I didn't tell them very much what to do. I said, you do your thing. That's what I casted you. But I like the way you work. You do your thing. I give you a topic and then you do your thing. And then I put it together. But I'm all the time in conversations. It's almost like you don't have to make those decisions at the end. I'll make them. So I release you from the responsibility of thinking about all of these things. I'll take care of it. So perform. You want to act? Act. You want to write? Write. You want to play music? Play music. Don't think about the light. I figure that out. So you go, I don't have to think about it. So I concentrate 100% in doing what I do. So hopefully he, she, they, it, will make decisions. My job as an actor is to act. Your job as a director is to put it together. If directorship means delegating things for somebody to hold it together for a while, so then you can really concentrate on what you're doing. Yes, we do need a director. If director means that you are in full service, in a subservient relationship to somebody who says what is done, how is done, when is done, and what is isn't done all the time, then I'm not so interested on that. But I have to say, at some point, someone needs to make a decision.
It's possible to imagine a director in lateral or horizontal relationship to others, where the director's contribution is to discern and listen and identify and sometimes delegate, but not necessarily in a vertical top-down way. Is that?
I think so. The problem with that, Noah, is that the difficulty with that is that the industry of theater sometimes chooses a director and they say you have 6 weeks. Yeah, 6 weeks of development of a piece.
Exactly, right.
And the only way, or one of the few possible ways, that you can create this clock type model of performance that sells, that people buy tickets for, unfortunately, is if you have a manager, not a director only, a manager who will say, that's the plan. That's the set design, the light design. That's the dramaturgical. These are the actor. That's how we work it. That's it. Everybody receives the rota. Everybody knows when and what to do. And within the agreed time, things are delivered and you get paid. Now, yes. that needs a manager. Otherwise, you get to the 6 weeks and you say, sorry, we are not finished yet.
It's an industrial model. Yeah. That's how people operate here. And most of the people, the actors I know, they're not Broadway actors, although that is the industrial model too. But there's no 6 weeks. If you're in a regional theater or, you know, some of the small theaters, like the kind that I work in, that they're 200 seats, that's 2 weeks. You know, maybe it's 3 or 4 weeks. You're exceedingly lucky. And your run is going to be 1 weekend, 2 weekends.
Exactly.
And everyone's dissatisfied with it. No one's enjoying that kind of crunch to learn material so quickly.
But I think, as you said before, if you want to think about the notion of a director as this lateral figure in the room, it is very doable. It's just, it doesn't fit very well with the logic of the industry.
Yeah.
It doesn't.
The director's role that I described is also, as you're describing it to me, tending, stewarding, shepherding the ensemble into being, attuning to what the ensemble is trying to be and nurturing that into its best form.
Yeah.
Seeing who can contribute what and making sure that there's the opportunity there for them to be that thing.
In the best of cases, yes. Yes. Every ensemble is a different adventure and you learn different things, hopefully, from each process. And I think as a director, what you learn mostly, or as a leader, what you learn mostly is how to work with performers. That's the beauty. I mean, working with actors is one of the most wonderful things you can do.
Do you see yourself as a teacher, an educator, a director? What is the word that you
I'm
feel?
I'm a theater maker.
A theater maker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You write, you think about it, you do research, you direct, you perform if you have to, you do lights if you have to. To direct also somebody, sometimes you may need to provide an actor with a context. So you need to be a dramaturg for a moment. If you want to teach something, instead of asking, just do this, you can create a pedagogical way of doing that for the actor. So then the categorization of names and roles, even though they are indicative of something in the process, is not so important for me. I think one needs to oscillate. You need to understand what the mask needs. Once you understand what the mask is asking for and you work in service of the mask, then you are what you are. You are what it's needed from you to be.
Here, the mask is, I mean, when you say the word mask, sometimes it's the individual performer. The mask could be the mask of the ensemble.
In this case, it's the project. Yes. The project, mm-hmm. which involves everyone and you. If you're working on a project, what is the project in need of? Sometimes I do occupy the role of the educator. Sometimes I do occupy the role of a researcher when I present in a symposium or whatnot. Sometimes I do work, like this past week, I worked with an actor from the States, and I was working as a director mainly there. I see myself in all those capacities. I do have a preference, though. I like to direct. I always say that I like to work with the food. It's like if you have a big kitchen, I work with the food, you know, just with the matter. Just give me the food. Then somebody else will, yeah, just bring the meat with all the grease, bring it and throw it on the table. Blah. Yeah. I'm those ones who receive that.
You're not going to go like open a cookbook and stare at a recipe for a long time. You want to just go right to the food.
That's me. Someone else will get the piece, will cook it in a particular way, will lay it out. So that will be a director, most likely. And then there will be a menu, you know. And then there will be, that's the marketing, those are the playhouses. And then somebody will look at it. But what I'm interested in seeing when I see the process or whatever, you know, even to a production, is if the body of the performer is fully alive. It's fully alive. It's embodying as much as possible. It's radiating meaning. And it continues to be playful and available. Because then, as long as that happens to me or for me, then there's the possibility to, as you say, to project through, to imagine new words. In few words, it's like the transparency of the performer is what keeps fascinating me. You know, it's a process of becoming transparent without losing your singularity. Yeah? But when I see that on stage, even if I don't like seeing in terms of a play, sometimes I see something, I'm like, I can watch that again and again. I can watch that actor or that actress. Whew, I can. I don't know what they're doing. I don't understand the world. I just love to see them live on stage. They're full of life, but they don't act ordinarily. They act extraordinarily. So you're seeing an actor in full swing. So that would be my preference. My hands kind of imprint the first sort of traces on that, you know, what I call the actor. It's not that I get the actor and then I do something with it. It's like we come together to begin to say, hey, what is an actor? You know, I'm not going to create an actor, but if I work with people who like to be watched somehow, or who like to say things in public somehow, or who have an interest to play also somehow, and to challenge notions of normativity somehow, and all of that. All right. Then all of us together can bring few elements and construct a mask. I'm not interested neither that the mask is truth, is based on truth. I'm interested that it's believable. It's fiction. It's full of falsity, but it looks very real. That's our craft. It looks so real that sometimes it makes you like think, is that them acting or is that them? All right. Yeah, I mean, and so then that's my preference. I think that is what theater happens, where we momentarily have this illusion. This illusion. Was that real? Oh, that looked really real. It's not. So that's why I say theater maker. But yes, I understand the roles of director, assistant, dramaturg, researcher, you name it. Yes.
One thing we haven't talked about, and this can be our last topic, the idea of the ensemble developing over time until all of its members really feel the sense of the whole of what they're making together. And you spoke about working on a movement score repeatedly over a period of weeks. And I'm guessing that you believe that repetition is one of the ways that ensembles tune into each other when what's happening really transcends the individuals involved and becomes a whole other thing of its own.
I think I would say repetition, not repetition. Repetition is not a quality. I don't think that is what brings the ensemble together. Repetition is helpful sometimes in order to play. Playfulness is what keeps it going. Once we have a structure that is clear, we begin to play with it. So we move away from the structure and it becomes something else that will require to get another sort of structure. But if at some point you don't know what you're doing because things become too much, you always need to know 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, go back to 7. I know what I'm doing. It's not the repetitiveness what holds the ensemble together. I say, oh, no, the familiarity with the structure that is shared by a group, that everybody knows that when you listen to a song, and Freddie Mercury will say, Mama, everybody knows this. How come we know this? Because it's a familiarity. Then we can play around the structure. So we can all sing the song, right? Then we can change the beats and turn a reggae song into rap or into soul. Sure. And then we can change the words and we can change the language. But so it's not about the repetitiveness. It's let's learn a structure. It's like when people learn the text. We all know the text. Mm-hmm. Text. What for? So where can we go with the text? Then the question will be, are we bound? Are we bound to the text the way it's written? Or now we know what's being said and everybody sort of knows when they're in or out. And it's your cue. Come on, Noah. Come on. Yeah, yeah. It's the beginning of a game to say it was your part or it's my part. So I talk and then you talk or no. The five of us say the same line. So we all turn and say, we were waiting for you. Oh, that could become a chorus. Maybe not. But we can begin to do things on top or around something that we are all familiarized. So repetition is one element that helps to develop familiarity. Not only repetition, but I would say if we create a structure and you are in the room and then the next day I come and I say, I want to work on 5, 7, 8, and 9 from the work we did yesterday. So can we take it from 5? Sure. If you don't know the structure, you're lost. What is 5? Remember 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 15? Yes. We're going to work 5 to 10. And then we can discuss only 5 to 10. The work on that session is embedded in a familiarity of the overall structure. That's all. Now, you do have the option to say, if you don't want to memorize it or if you don't want to repeat it in your body, note it somewhere that you learn it. So how would you learn it? How would it be familiar for you? I don't mind if you don't want to repeat anything, don't repeat. But if you do go and you get up and then you do something and somebody, can you do it again? And you do it again. Can you do it again? And every time you're changing the way you move and say, what are you doing with your feet? Well, I don't know. Repeat. If you don't repeat it similarly, you will never know what you're doing with your feet. It's not a repetition for me. It's a repetition for the performer to develop awareness of what they are doing. You realize what you do with your mouth. Do you open your mouth when you talk? Do you bite your lips? Are you entering the space with the heels of your feet or with the toes? Yeah. Why do you move always laterally? What happens to the space around you? Is it alive? Yeah. Well, you're doing all of this and you turn. The space behind you disappears. Where? In the turn. We may end up in a semicircular form on stage, but actually it's a diagonal. Ah. So the body understands that a diagonal like this, if it's elastic, you can stretch it and stretch it and stretch it and turns it into a semicircle. But if you reduce the intensity of the semicircle slowly, 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 you get into a sort of diagonal form. Interesting. Size, intensity, speed, direction. So I can never work on the direction, speed, and size of movement if the movements are always changing. because I always need to note something different. And it's like, all right, can we work on a certain emotion? And where does the emotion come? Hopefully, for me, and I talk about for me, that's the way I find it. It is very helpful to get a score. What for? To get rid of the score later. I get rid of it entirely. Oh, I don't need it anymore. I have my lines, or I have my world. I enter the space and I do my things. And as I'm doing my part, there are moments when my body might make a turn and I have a memory. That moment when I turn and I look at that window or that direction in the space, you know, I turn right and I look at the Baltic. So it's not, it's nothing, you know, it's not a detail. When I look right and I look up, I see the Baltic and I see my son. I see the eyes of my son in the space, in the distance. Oh, in the score, that was number 7. Remember, 7, we turn, you turn. Forget about that later, but when you turn, 7 is somewhere in your body.
Yeah.
Not that you need to know 7. So we first score it to then get rid of it, and the body begins to remember marks. Then I say, repeat it, Noah, or do what you want. And at the moment, say, you see, of all these things that we explore, there's this moment, and that moment that seems to be the most interesting one. And we can put an X and say, in the score that looks like number 3, number 10, and number 12. But now there's a theme, which is leaving home, the descent, and the return.
And at that point, you're traveling on a memory map.
And then there's no more score.
Yeah.
But the score had been a layer, a foundational layer upon which it's like a palimpsest work.
That brings us back to time, because a palimpsest can only be created with time.
Over time, absolutely.
Cannot be created in a day or in even 2 weeks.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's why time is the most precious material we are. We don't have or don't have time, you know. Actors are time. You know, when people say, I don't have time, it's like, when you are on stage, you are time. In English, it's beautiful. You say, I am 20 years old. In Spanish, we all age. I have 20 years. It. But for me, it makes total sense to be time. You are time.
Yes.
So then if you are time, and time is the most important thing, you need to use your own material in the best possible manner. It's not that you need to use your time in the space. You need to use yourself, the know thyself, right? It requires time, as you say, to work in a palimpsest. But once you gain familiarity with a palimpsest modality, you begin to do this rather quick. Trust me, you begin to create it rather quick, and then you develop things super, super fast. And somebody else from outside say, that takes forever. Yes, but this actor had done it so many times, or enough times, for that it's the palimpsest. You've done it here for 6 months, and then for 4, and then for 3, and then now you do it in 2 weeks. How do you get there so quickly? Well, because we spend 20 years together. Of course we do it. There's no need to have such a long time, because just by evoking the memory of the way of working, the palimpsest is updated. That's the good thing, that to be redundant. Over time, the amount of time needed to create a palimpsest is less.
Well, that really brings us full circle, because you began with a story of the woman from Japan who says, I'm here to change. And you said, you may not, but you may, and if you're ready, it can happen very quickly.
I think so. Yeah. If you're ready, for all the reasons that you might be ready, then you go to a week's work and you go, we have it. We have it. Sure. How come? Well, chemistry and the right type of things. But there's so much going on around us all the time, that the necessity of having, of dedicating the time. That's why when I did my training at Lecoq, for example, I say that to my students, to say at a point of your life, I'm going to dedicate 1 or 2 full years for this. Some things I like, other things I won't like, but I will pay attention to few aspects of my work for this year or two. Those might be the only 2 years or the only year of your life where you will do so, and that's it. But it's great to have that possibility, you know, to say we need to pay attention, and then we need to go into the room and work in this kind of patient manner, layer, 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 layer. And eventually, once you get it, it's not a recipe, but it's a methodology. Will you always get results? No, I don't know if the results that you desire you will get, but you will always be able to get a mask. That for sure. You know, that's sort of my point. And for me, that happens in the context of an ensemble. If it's an ensemble of professional actors, like I work with professional actors sometimes, you know, that been together for 30 years. It's lovely, yeah. Noah. I work with them for a week and I just say one or two things to them. Boom, 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 boom. They put it together. They create it. They make it happen. They create the whole world. But again, these are actors who work with tech. So they are very tech-based. And then I also work with actors that I train physically. The notion of embodied poetics is different. That's a whole different story. Yeah? When the body is in full swing in terms of poetics in the space, then it's like, there is a difference between this body and this body. Yeah. What is the difference? The awareness. It's the awareness. It's almost like some bodies are just thin in space and others are super thick. They radiate so much, so much, so much they radiate. That as they move and as they do things, there's a sense of awareness of everything moving along with them, not just in the space, in the visual space of the body, that the whole space is alive. That's what we're talking about. What makes the difference between one actor and the other one? The presence of the actor and the awareness. This is what we can train in theater. Then it's your soul, your singularity, which is the uniqueness of each actor. You bring your own color to something, but we can train primary areas of presence and primary areas of awareness. We cannot teach you to play, and we cannot teach you to be yourself. You are yourself despite of you. These are just few thoughts on theater that I can share with you today.
Yeah, that's really good. Thank you so much.